IsraelNationalRadio.com.
Israel, Appointment with Destiny. Every home should own this DVD. This stirring film documentary dramatizes the history of Zionism, the Jewish people, and the State of Israel. Beautiful, current, and inspiring. All this for only $5.95. Check out our website at www.israelsdestiny.com. www.israelsdestiny.com.
Now, the only independent news talk network in the Middle East, Israel National Radio, presents the Tovia Singer Show. Here's Tovia Singer.
U.S. Ambassador John Bolton, he's going to be joining us right now. The clouds are swirling. Iran's leader has just gone to Damascus to make a pact. The man who's the voice in the wilderness, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, right now on Israel National Radio. Don't touch the dial. Singer here, Israel National Radio. Joining me right now is former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. It's an honor to have you on. Thank you for joining us here on air.
Glad to be here.
Hey, great to have you on. Let's talk about Iran. I mean, that's a very big issue here in the land of Israel. It's the day is nice, but we know that there is an enormous threat coming from Iran, 2,000 kilometers due east. There is all sorts of proposals in the United Nations to isolate Iran. Do you think that any of the possible sanctions coming from the UN Security Council will work, could be effective in stopping Ahmadinejad in going ahead with his nuclear program?
No, I don't. I think it's almost certainly too late for the sanctions to be effective. You know, when we first started trying to move through the International Atomic Energy Agency to the Security Council back in 2002 and 2003, we wanted to get there very quickly, certainly no later than about 2004, because the Iranians were making steady progress across the whole range of the nuclear fuel cycle, which they've continued to do. So the effect of this four going on 5 years of diplomacy has been to give Iran time, which is an asset that proliferators need. I think at this point, unfortunately, sanctions, we're past the point where sanctions can have an impact.
It sounds to me like that the only option available to Israel, the United States, is a military, an attack on Iran's nuclear program, taking out its missiles, the Shahab-3, and taking out possibly this regime that threatens the West.
Well, I think regime change would be the most desirable option, because not only would that provide a circumstance in which a new, hopefully, government in Iran that was a representative government would be most likely to give up the pursuit of nuclear weapons, but might also be persuaded to stop its support for terrorism in Iraq, its support for Hezbollah, Hamas, and even now the Taliban in Afghanistan. But I think conditions in Iran show that the government there is more fragile than might appear at first glance. So it's definitely worth pursuing. The difficulty, of course, is that it could be complex and it could be time-consuming, which would bring us to the military option as a last resort before Iran actually acquired a weapons capability. And, you know, I don't advocate the use of military force happily. I think it's an unattractive option, but if the choice, and in the real world you have to make choices, if the choice is between a nuclear-capable Iran on the one hand and the use of military force on the other to prevent that, then I think the second alternative clearly becomes preferable.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. How much time do we have?
I think we have a very limited amount of time. The Iranians, as reported by the International Atomic Energy Agency, have mastered the complex scientific and technological skills they need to engage in uranium enrichment. They don't have a massive capability there yet, but once you learn how to do it, in small amounts, once you perfect that process, then it's simply a question of how many resources you pour into the program to build up to an industrial scope enrichment capability, larger and larger and larger, obviously, the more resources you pour into it. So, in effect, I think we're at a point where the capability to produce nuclear weapons is now largely in Iran's hands. And there can be different estimates when that capability will come to fruition. And reasonable people can disagree on that. But I think where there cannot be disagreement is that Iran continues to pursue the strategic decision to acquire such weapons. When precisely that is of much less importance.
Should we be concerned that what the United States used to prevent the Soviets from attacking it, mutual assured destruction, won't work, that it won't work against this regime, given that these are fundamentalist Muslims who believe in some sort of apocalyptic eschatology, and therefore that none of these measures that we use in the past to contain other threatening governments won't work here?
Well, I think deterrence based on the threat of retaliation obviously requires the other side to accept the calculus that retaliation by us on them is so unacceptable that they don't make their strike in the first place. But it's very hard to see how a regime that's based on theocratic notions of achieving immortality through dying in the process of attacking is ever going to be anything that's subject to classic theories of deterrence. And I think as well, at least in Ahmadinejad, there's an irrationality from our perspective that simply makes it unacceptable to leave the decision as to when and under the circumstances which he will use or threaten to use nuclear weapons. Even if deterrence might be theoretically possible, I don't think the way we lived in the Cold War was a terribly happy circumstance to live under, constantly worried about whether the Soviet Union would launch a first strike. I think that's why the Bush national security doctrine that basically said preventing governments from getting nuclear or chemical or biological weapons is the best way to deal with proliferation, because if you're worried about deterrence after it, you're too late. It's better to prevent the weapons from coming into the hands of terrorists and rogue states in the first place.
Hezbollah, Iran's client regime in Lebanon, all reports are that they are armed to the teeth. They have somehow UN Resolution 1701 failed in preventing Hezbollah from rearming. The UNIFIL troops, the international forces placed after the war last summer, that did not seem to work at all. Do you have any doubt in your mind that Hezbollah, they're arming, they're preparing to assist Iran to attack Israel should Iran be attacked by the United States or Israel to take out its nuclear weapons?
Well, I don't have any doubt Hezbollah takes its direction from Tehran, perhaps indirectly sometimes through Damascus, but the level of funding and other support is simply too great to conclude otherwise. What exactly Iran would do if a military force were used against its nuclear program, I don't know. One thing I hope it would encourage would be for those in Iran who despise the current regime in Iran to take steps against it, which might make it more difficult for that regime to order its surrogates elsewhere in the world to carry out retaliation. But obviously, as long as Hezbollah remains armed and equipped, and there's no doubt it has been resupplied and restocked since the war in the summer of 2006, it's a threat, and a threat not only to Israel, but a threat to the democratic forces in Lebanon that would just as soon have a representative government and not one controlled by a group of religious fanatics.
Do you feel confident at all that if the current regime in Iran were taken out, that the people of Iran would want a pro-Western government that they would want change? Because we've seen democracy essentially fail in the Palestinian Authority. We've seen Hamas elected in a landslide victory. It wasn't that long ago, and now they've brutally taken over the Gaza Strip. Do you feel that in Iran, if there is a regime change, that there is a real hope?
Well, it's hard to imagine it can get worse than the current regime. So from that point of view, I don't think anything is lost. And I do think that there are, in the Iranian diaspora around the world, certainly in the case of Iranian Americans, a very strong feeling that they want a secular democratic regime. Now, there are no certainties, but once again, remember that there were, and still are, large chunks of a very sophisticated, very educated Iranian population. They see what kind of life is possible in the countries around them, the countries of the West. They want to be free of the rule of the mullahs, and I think that to the extent you could have a change of regime that was accomplished at Iranian hands, you would be in a much more secure position, recognizing, as I say, there are no guarantees.
Are you satisfied with the way George W. Bush, President of the United States, the way he's handling this crisis with Iran? Is he stepping in the proper speed here, or do you think that he should be doing things differently?
Well, I think the president personally feels very concerned about the prospect of a nuclear holocaust committed by Iran against Israel. But he's very consumed with questions of Iraq and other matters, and I think largely a lot of the Iran policy is being run out of the State Department, which has for some years been very sympathetic to the European approach. And in fact, it's the failure of that European approach, nearly 5 years of failed diplomacy, that's left us with the limited options we have now. But I have no doubt how President Bush feels on this personally and how strongly he feels about it. Whether he's able to implement it or not in the next 18 months, I just honestly don't know.
Do you think that the fact that the war in Iraq is unpopular in the United States, that the president's approval rating is a little more than 30%, and while it's better than what the Congress is getting, there has to be some intrepidation in the White House about going on another military venture. Do you think that Iraq is holding back, sort of tying the hands of the White House?
I don't think it does in every respect. I think it obviously has some impact, but I think the president feels very strongly he needs to do what's right, and the question is whether in his remaining time in office dealing with Iran, whether he follows his own instincts or whether he's talked out of them, basically. And as I say, I just don't know where that will come out.
Yeah. Ambassador John Bolton, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Israel National Radio. It's an honor to have you.
Very glad to do it.
Thank you. A truly courageous man of our generation. It stuns me. It shocks me that, yes, Democratic lawmakers, senators, would work so diligently, understanding the immense threat that is posed by Iran's nuclear program. Folks should have understood how serious this issue is. They should have put aside politics, and they should have stood together behind this man, one of the great men, and thank God he's there. And I wish I could have spent a little time converting John Bolton to Judaism. And then, after we stick him in the water, we'll make him Prime Minister of Israel. What a remarkable man. Thank God for him. And in the meantime, literally, well, there are war clouds swirling. Iran's leader, Mohammad Ahmadinejad, flew to Syria. He jets to Damascus for special talks with the leader of Syria, with President Bashar Assad, with Mr. Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and you know that can't be good. You know those are very dangerous talks. These were conversations at the highest level of terror organizations. You would think this would not be a good time for Ehud Olmert to be releasing terrorists from Israeli prisons. you can be sure that they were strengthened by that, and you can be absolutely certain that the conversation between Nasrallah, Bashir Assad, and Ahmadinejad went like this. When Israel or the United States attacks Iran's nuclear program, you, Syria, make sure that you attack Israel with biological weapons. You, Nasrallah, make sure that you start using those very fancy missiles we shipped and aim them at Tel Aviv and beyond. You're going to be certain that's what's going on. This trip comes as war drums continue to sound throughout the Middle East, warning of a potential war between Syria and Israel. In fact, the leader of Iran declared that this should be a very hot summer in the Middle East. And I'll say this, I please God, this will be a very, very hot summer in Tehran. That's what I would like to see. I would like to see Ehud Olmert spending less time swinging with the terrorists and more time devoted to protecting the land of Israel. I'd like to see him go into Gaza and wipe out the enemy. I don't think that's going to happen. And as we're speaking now, rockets just landed in Sderot, the southwestern town of the Holy Land that just is right up next to the Gaza Strip. So the situation is enormously serious. Tehran is getting a little nervous. They're bracing for a U.S. or perhaps an Israeli attack on its nuclear program. They're probably a little bit more worried about the United States than Israel. And they've got a pact. No doubt that Damascus is going together with Persia, Syria and Persia. This is biblical. No question about it. And Lebanon's leader, Nasrallah, and he's the real leader in that country, they're all preparing for a war with Israel. Let me say this. This is a whole different kind of war. This is not shooting with rockets and grenades on hills in Judea and Samaria or in the Sinai Desert. We're talking about missiles now. We're talking about a country, Israel, so tiny, where virtually all of its population live in the large urban centers of the country. We're talking about an extraordinary vulnerability. And you could be certain that the Arabs living in Israel don't care about their own lives and can't wait for the missiles to fly overhead. If a missile, God forbid, does make it into Israel, hope it lands in the Gaza Strips and takes them all out. That's the one thing that will give me a little peace in my life. If one missile makes it through, we wipe out the rest, and we wipe out Iran, we wipe out the enemy, we smash them to pieces. But one of those missiles just makes it into the Gaza Strips and takes care of the sickos in the Gaza Strip, I'd be very happy. We then come in with a shovel, knock away the debris, and build Gush Katif bigger and better, more beautiful than ever. That's what I would like to see. How does that sound? And you can be sure that Ahmadinejad, he's trying to, at the very least, create a very powerful impression that he's got solid relations with Syria, a member of the real axis of evil. And these words, the axis of evil, used by George W. Bush in his 2002 State of the Union address, they better mean it. They can't stop with Iraq. And they're hoping to deter the Americans from attacking. They're trying their best to ensure that they could delay enough time to put off any kind of military attack. They're trying to scare the folks in Washington. They're trying to terrify the Jews in Jerusalem. You can be sure they're trying to announce to the world, be careful, don't attack us. Let us make these weapons of mass destruction. We're going to finish off this nuclear stuff before you even get a chance to think about attacking us. And be careful because Syria's on our side. Be warned because Nasrallah of Hezbollah is working with us. You can be sure that Hamas is on board. You can be certain that thanks to Israel's fleeing Lebanon repeatedly, you can be certain that due to Israel's non-action in the Gaza Strip, I'll change that, destruction of Jewish communities within Gaza, you can be sure that strengthens, enables the enemy. You can be certain of that. And meanwhile, each and every day, American young men are injured and killed in Iraq by weapons that are smuggled across the Syrian border, by weapons that are brought in, manufactured in Iran, and it's time for a response. I mean, do you ever look at the images of Adolf Hitler when he rose to power in 1933, elected democracy, elected by the people? And you ever wonder yourself, boy, if folks would have only killed him then. Did you ever wonder that? Did you ever look at pictures of Hitler's Germany before World War II? You look at images of Hitler speeches in 1937 and 38. You look at him at the Olympic Games, 1936. And you wonder yourself, you know what, if somebody would have taken out him and the leadership, you know, a few bombs would have saved the world, tens of millions of people. Would have saved the world if we could have taken him out. Well, and what would have happened if he would have? What would have occurred if good people did the good thing, did the right thing before World War II and taken out Adolf Hitler, taken him out in 1933, smashed him when he was in a Bavarian prison years earlier, taken him out in 1938, immediately after or before Kristallnacht, makes no difference. How would the world be different? Do you ever wonder? Do you wish that something had been done? And remember, back in as Hitler was going to war, he didn't have a nuclear weapon. He wanted to have, he dreamt of having a nuclear weapon, but he didn't possess it. He dreamt of having a weapon of mass destruction, but he didn't yet have it. He had the bullets, he had conventional bombs, he had grenades, he had masses that were poisoned, but he didn't yet have those weapons. Here we got a Hitler coming in, a Muslim Hitler from Iran, and he's ready to go, and he's not going to war before he's got the nuclear weapons. And the question is, we're maybe months away. Are we going to do something? Are we going to learn from the past? Are we going to seize the moment? Are we going to examine the failures of the past and ensure that we don't repeat them? Are we going to look at the great men like Churchill, who had the courage to stand up against that Hitler? We're going to learn from his success and emulate it. That's the big question here. You listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. Don't touch the radio.
Hi, this is Ishai Fleischer, and I want to recommend to you Israel Rose at IsraelRose.com. It's an incredible service that I've personally used. Roses from Israel, sent to anywhere in the continental U.S. Fast, not expensive, amazing quality, beautiful roses, right from the land of Israel to the table of your mom, grandma, grandpa, your own Shabbos table, and it's from the land of Israel. Try it at IsraelRose.com. That's IsraelRose.com.
Left-wingers don't know what to do with him. Anti-Semites hate his guts. They would give anything to get him off the radio. Tovia Singer. Coming up next on Israel National Radio. We'll be right back.
Israel, Max Singer here, Israel National Radio. One piece of housekeeping. I'm going to be off next week. Next week is the week of Tisha B'Av, and I'll be joining you back the following right here on Israel National Radio. A Qassam rocket hit Sderot. As I mentioned, there is one person who's hospitalized, suffering from shock, and was evacuated to a hospital in Ashkelon. This just occurred. And still Ehud Olmert decides to respond to the Qassam rockets in Sderot by releasing terrorists from Israeli prisons and offering amnesty to 100 others. It's a different kind of strategy. I know you're not, this is not the kind of strategy right away that we kind of, it's a very brilliant, insightful strategy. Terrorists shoot rockets and we give them amnesty. It's a different kind. I know it's not the kind of response that one would instinctively come to when considering how to respond to terrorism. It's a new kind of concept. The more rockets they launch, the more terrorists we release, the more explosives that land in Israeli cities, the more terrorists we give amnesty to. It's a whole different approach. In fact, as Syria's allies, Hamas, is launching rockets into the Jewish state, reports are out. In fact, Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Mark Regev, he confirmed the rumors, what was well known, that Israel for the past few months has been trading messages with Syria. Very inspiring. You could see that the messages going back between Israel, between Olmert and Damascus, you can be sure that it's come to tremendous fruition, because as a result of the messages going back and forth, you can see that Hamas is taking it very seriously, and they're shooting more rockets into the land of Israel. It's a very interesting approach to dealing with terrorism. So the more rockets that come in, the more amnesty we give, the more missiles that fly in, the more we send messages, love messages, between Jerusalem and Damascus. So of course the terrorists are laughing. Of course the terrorists know they have nothing to lose. Of course the terrorists keep threatening. Of course Syria, I mean, you have to ask yourself the question, why would Syria even be considering going to war against the Jewish state? Syria did not do so well in past wars. They weren't a big hit in the wars. They weren't a big success in 67 and 73. Going to wars with Israel has been very costly for Syria. So why do they keep wanting to go to war? I'll tell you why, because they have nothing to lose. In a normal situation, you're afraid to go to war, because if you go to war, you might lose something. And if you lose it, it's gone. But Syria knows that it can go to war and it'll be rewarded and it'll be offered back whatever was lost. They don't care about their own people. They don't care about human life. That's how the modern access work. That's how the enemy works. In the Arab world, they're killing each other constantly. They're starving each other constantly. You have wealthy countries in the Middle East and the people have nothing, live in mud huts. For them, it's all pride, national pride. So therefore, Syria doesn't mind. They can go to war over and over again. It makes no difference. What do they lose? And if they go to war and Israel captures any of their soldiers or captures any of their terrorists, so they release them anyways in exchange for a turtle. We release the terrorists, they don't do anything. We give them amnesty. They know if they go to war, Israel offered all back in exchange for peace. As I said to you, Syria, any country that loses every war they go into shouldn't be demanding from the victors concessions, but they're dealing with a different kind of leadership, a different kind of government, so therefore there's an approach they take, it's very involved. So they're sending messages back and forth, and as Israel is sending messages to Syria, Syria is wrapping their arms around Ahmadinejad, and Ahmadinejad has declared that he's going to wipe Israel off the map and we're going to have a very hot summer. And that's what's going back and forth. So terrorists are rewarded for their acts, for their crimes. Terrorists can commit any crime they want, and even if they don't want it, how long are they going to stick around in the prison? They can do very nicely in the prison. The terrorists know that if they get captured, they get arrested by Israel, so they know that they can capture an Israeli soldier, and they can demand thousands in return, they'll be freed. So it's just a temporary vacation, where they get to sort of get away from the family, get away from the yenting, the screaming wife all day long, screaming with the tablecloth over her head. So he's taking a break. They love it. They have a fantastic, they believe me, they have a very good in Israeli prisons. They get the daily newspaper. I'm sure they're given massages every day. They're doing fantastic. And they take a vacation. In fact, the terrorists don't have to go to Cozumel. They don't have to go on vacation. They get arrested. That's their vacation. And then it comes time. They take a few soldiers. They kill another few. And they go and they get released. And this lesson is not comical. It's serious. That's what we're teaching them. We're teaching the enemy that they can't lose a war. Because if they win, they win. If they win, they win. If they lose, they win anyway. They're given back anything they lost that is returned to them. Well, we plead with them, take it back. So that's why the ongoing communications with Syria. There's nothing to communicate with Syria. Let me tell you what Syria wants. Syria wants the Golan Heights in their hands and the rest of Israel destroyed. That's what Syria wants. If you don't want to be destroyed, don't talk to them. Just take out a big rifle and aim it at Damascus and explain to them that if they get into another war, we're going to take more, and we're going to push them into Iraq, and we're going to push them into China, that's all. And they'll lose more. And then you clear with them, so then maybe they'll get it. Just make it very clear. There are consequences for their actions. You don't appease the enemy. You don't embrace the enemy. What you do is you destroy the enemy. You seek out victory. Next war, no more ceasefires, only victory, only unilateral surrender, only unconditional surrender. Arabs come with their diaper off their head, we surrender, then we'll let them be. We don't need, you see, there's this idea that we need diplomatic friendships. We don't need that. They don't want to be your friend. Well, how much abuse does one have to take to realize that the other individual does not want to be a friend? They don't want to be a friend. And we don't need that. I don't need Syrian ambassadors in Tel Aviv. Don't need that. I don't need to go on vacation to Damascus for a suntan. We don't need it. They don't have anything we want. There's nothing in Syria that Jews want. We don't need it. There's nothing that they have that we desire. We don't need diplomatic relations. Israelis are not craving to go to Syria to go sneeing and skiing and snorkeling. We don't need that. But it's part of this disease of appease. That's what it is. Of course, when it came to Omona, and we pleaded with the Omer government, there were signals. Then they can't appease. They came in smashing heads when it came to Omona. That's what we're up against. A senior Israeli military commander has just informed the public that Israel has a plan ready to mount a major attack in Gaza to deter Hamas rearmament in the Strip. But this senior Israeli military commander has declared time is running out to implement it. So they made a plan. They brought together all these military guys. They figured out a plan how to destroy Hamas, and that plan is sitting in a safe, and aha, they're having a whole kind of relationship with Syria. They're giving amnesty to the terrorists. They're releasing the murderers from the prisons. That's what's happening. Do you know why the Israeli government is not going to attack Hamas? Do you know why? Reason number one is they don't care. So it's a tragedy, but they don't care enough. Number two, their ego is in the way. It's a big problem, because if the Jewish state has to go in with military, has to go in with its army to attack Hamas, to carry out whatever this plan is, to smash Hamas, what that means is, if they go through with this plan, what that demonstrates is that that the expulsion of Jews from Gush Katif was a failure. That's what it says. Why would Israel? We were promised that if the Jews from Gaza would be expelled and the Arab terrorists would replace them, what would happen? There would be peace, and the Arab terrorists would build swimming pools and tennis courts until they would live in peace. And what's happened? Exactly what we said would happen would occur. These Jewish communities would be used as a launching pad to destroy the rest of the state of Israel. And we're seeing the rockets come through on a daily basis. So as long as the Jewish state doesn't go in, and he said they'll go in for a little thing, sort of a stopgap, a sort of damage control, they'll go in a little bit for 2 hours, then come out. But to go for a massive military attack on the Gaza to smash Hamas, if they do that, they understand they're declaring that what they had said to us back in the beginning of 2005, back in 2004, that the expulsion of Jews of Gaza would somehow bring peace to the rest of Israel, we realized that was a huge lie. Well, that's why they won't do it. In order for the Jewish state to go in a massive military attack against Hamas, in order to do that, they have to admit that the plot that they came up with back at the end of 2003 sought to convince the Jewish state of throughout 2004 and carried out in 2005, literally 2 years ago, exactly. They have to admit that the whole thing was a failure and everything that we said was the truth, and they don't want to do it. And they would have rockets flying into Ashkelon. They would rather have Qassams landing in Sderot. They would rather watch Hamas building up with a massive, let me just quote this, this unnamed general has just informed Israeli reporters, that just happened today, yesterday, Thursday, that Hamas has a massive buildup in Gaza. And Israel only has a plan for attack. Hamas is doing it. They're more powerful than anyone dreamed. In the old days, before the expulsion, in order for them to get bullets in, they would have to crawl through tunnels just to get a bullet in. Now they're coming in with rockets and missiles and anti-tank weapons that are coming from Iran. Now they got the IEDs that are the roadside bombs that are being used against American forces in Iraq, there in Gaza. Everybody admits this. Money is flowing in constantly. The borders that we were promised would be protected by the European Union and by the PLO. Apparently the European Union didn't take a big interest in Israel's security. We were told that Israel should abandon the control of the Philadelphia route, should abandon the border between Gaza and the rest of the land of Israel, and the European Union, the gas chamber countries, they would monitor everything that's going on. And they do. They monitor every day. They're watching terrorists going in with weapons. They watch it. Oh, look at that. Another bomb coming through. Another 3,000 rockets coming through. Another 3,000 bullets and grenade launches coming through. And the PLO would guard us in the PLO. That's what we were told. Now, if somebody normally would say that to you, you would send them to a crazy house. We not only didn't send them to a nut house, we actually went along with it. We signed on to it. That's what we did. Condoleezza Rice came into Israel. She sat in the David Citadel Hotel. She pulled Ehud Olmert by the ear and says, you're going to sign this, and you're going to allow the European Union to monitor and control your borders. And you know what happened? A big disaster. Israel, of course, wanted to show they're a little strong. We have to watch. So they said, you can watch, but you can't do anything. So they've been watching and not doing anything. And we've been signing on to it. We've been signing on to the plots and the plans of Condoleezza Rice in Lebanon. 1701 UN resolution calls upon United Nations UNIFIL troops to monitor Hezbollah activity in Lebanon to ensure part of the resolution is that Hezbollah would not be armed. And Hezbollah is better armed today than they ever were. And everybody admits that nothing happened. There was no protection at the border between Lebanon and Syria. And all arms, not a single truck was stopped to prevent Hezbollah from becoming rearmed. No one. And everybody said at the time, everybody in this day said, this is the worst thing that you can possibly do. That no one could protect the state of Israel except for the Jewish people. No one. If you want an international force to protect the Jewish people in the south, you can have Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews. That's your international force. If you want international force in the north to protect Israel from Lebanon, the only international force you can use is white Jews and black Jews and a few yellow Jews. That's it. Ethiopian Jews and Ashkenazic. That's as international, multinational as we're going to get. We'll have some soldiers who speak Yiddish and another few soldiers who speak Ladino. That's it. That's as international as it gets. We'll take Americans who are now in the IDF, and we'll take a few from Morocco. That's as international. We'll have some soldiers that eat gefilte fish and another few soldiers that eat whatever they eat in there in the Morocco with the couscous, and that's international. That's what I say. You want international, have one Jew that eats gefilte fish and the other one that eats couscous. That's it. You could only have Jews protecting the land of Israel. You can't have folks from Indonesia, Malaysia, and gonorrhea. They're not going to protect the land of Israel. We cannot trust the French to protect the land of Israel. The last time we trusted the French, they stuck us in a gas chamber. You can't trust the Europeans. I know we'd like to trust the Germans and the Austrians, but the truth is, the last time we trusted the Austrians, they put us in front of a pit and mowed us down. That's what they did. So we kind of learned from 60 years ago, it's not a good idea to trust your security to the Europeans. The Europeans may not have the interest of the Jewish people at heart. That's an interesting concept that we can learn from World War II, but it's probably not a good idea to look to the Europeans for the safety of the Jewish people. Because when the Europeans get their hands on a Jew, they stick them in a gas chamber. That's what they do. As European Jewry is going up in the chimney, they're going and repopulating the land of Israel, making sure that Israel can never again be in the hand of the children of Israel. You know what? They failed. We're here and they're out. But we have an Israeli leadership that's really I don't want to just say leftist, because there were Israeli leaders back in Ben Gurion and so on who were no right wingers, but these guys would be thrown in prison. These guys would have been put on trial for treason. This was unimaginable. No one talked this way. Vanessa Redgrave didn't talk like this. People didn't speak the way these leftists are today. Folks were not as off the wall. There's a pollution going on. A demented mindset going on. Here you have Ramon, the minister. He forced himself on an Israeli whoop. He comes out 5 seconds later. You think he'd be a little embarrassed? No, he's talking now about how he's going to destroy 70% of Judea and Samaria. It's mind-boggling. The recidivism rate? Among this, like pedophiles. They can't hold themselves back for 5 minutes. And it absolutely is astonishing. Israel goes on and have communicate. Israel should make it very clear to the Syrians. Golan Heights is Jewish, it's Israeli. You're never going to get it back. That should be the message. It should be very clear. Never. Never. And if you go to war with us again, you'll lose more. And they'll learn. And you keep going to us, we'll smash you more and smash you harder. That's what we should do. But instead, Israel sends messages that it wants peace with Syria. Could you imagine that? Why would we want peace with Syria? What do we need to have a relationship with Syria? Syria needs to know that if it wants to be at peace with Israel, it better watch itself and guard that border and make sure no weapons of any kind are ever shipped into Lebanon. You have to wipe out Hezbollah and warn the Syrians that the Golan Heights, fantastic. You're not going to have it again. Don't dream about it. And if you start up with us, we're going to move further east and we're going to take more land. That's all. Until you surrender. Unconditional surrender is the only way. But unfortunately, we have a leadership that's lost its way. And we need new leadership, and we need it quickly. It's unfortunate, but it seems as though we're not going to get a change without bloodshed. We're not going to have an epiphany without the loss of life. We're not going to have a turnaround without disaster, without pain. Just the way it is. So much could have been avoided if folks would have seen, witnessed, and made the right decision. But unfortunately, they didn't. Unfortunately, throughout history, it requires something disastrous for people to wake up. People had to die first. Disasters had to occur. It would be nice if people would wake up. No, we had to go to Lebanon for 34 days to realize that Ehud Olmert's an idiot. Could you imagine that? It would have been nice if they would have known beforehand, if Israeli citizens would have not voted with such numbers for Kadima, would have understood that this man is incapable of protecting the country. He can't even protect his bathroom. He's going to protect the state of Israel. And it would have been nice, but they didn't. What did it take? It took a Lebanon. It took a 34-day war that ended up in a disaster. Every promise made by Ehud Olmert fell apart. He initially didn't go in with too much soldiers, then the last 5 minutes he sends in people, and people lose their lives. But they needed that to see that the failure, that Ehud Olmert, the promise that Hezbollah would be neutralized, Goldwasser and Eldad Regev would not come home as promised. They, and the reason they're being held is because of the, it's very simple. Because in the past we've rewarded terrorists. We taught Hezbollah that we're gonna trade all sorts of terrorists sitting in Israeli prisons in exchange for a drug deal. That's what we told them. We're gonna make these out of whack trades, and of course they would go on, the terrorists that are released would go on to murder other Jews. There's no learning. We need a lot of prayer. Shabbos is upon us. Tisha B'Av is upon us. We pray. I wish all of you a very meaningful fast. And may this be the year that we rejoice instead of mourn. Thank you for joining us here on Israel National Radio. Shabbat Shalom. Oh.